Okay, let's get rolling again. And let's turn to page 9 in the handouts. Because when we explain this stuff, it's easy for it to sound simple and straightforward. You've got this nice set of principles, this nice protocol. You do step 1 and then step 2 and then step 3. And obviously, real life does not necessarily cooperate with us. And real life practice of CBT is dealing with the reality, not matching through some abstract protocol. So what we've got here, this is taken from a case study of cognitive processing therapy for a woman who has had repeated sexual victimization. And, you know, cognitive processing therapy is, you know, packaged, you know, it's a 10 to 12 session package with a bunch of different principles involved. And the initial treatment plan is we're going to do cognitive processing therapy, except this client has some additional issues, so we're going to add some other CBT chunks onto it. We're going to establish and maintain a good collaborative relationship. And this client has been victimized in a relationship by a guy who is still in the community. So, A, we need to put some safety planning in here, too. If we were just dealing with a history of sexual abuse, we don't have to do safety planning. If the client is not currently safe, that takes priority over everything else. Also, the client is suicidal to some extent. So in addition to doing cognitive processing therapy, we're going to be dealing with suicidality. And in addition to PTSD and depression, this client has some compulsive hand washing and compulsive cleaning. So we're going to need to do some exposure and response prevention on the OCD chunk of things. And the client has some sexual issues, which we're going to at least need to do some education about, and we'll see whether she needs sex therapy in addition. So, wait a minute, we've got a 10 to 12 session package with some add-ons. This may well take us more than 10 to 12 sessions. And then we start actually doing this. Okay, session 1, they do the standard education about PTSD and depression and outline the treatment package. Session 2, the client writes her impact statement. They review the impact statement. We're doing standard cognitive processing therapy. And they start on some cognitive strategies. And they're doing written exposure to the sexual victimization that the therapist initially knows about, which was all the stuff perpetrated by Fred. And they start doing exposure and response prevention on compulsive cleaning. And then in sessions 6 through 11, Fred is threatening the client, and we're busy doing safety planning. The client's suicidal. We're doing suicide prevention. We end up getting, you know, the client won't contract for safety. We've got to figure out how to deal with that. We end up getting the client into a woman's shelter where she's safe for the time being. And this has taken 5 sessions, so we've bumped our package back 5 more sessions. And then some sexual issues come up, so we spend a couple sessions on sexuality and education around sexuality. And then we're back to dealing with some of the dysfunctional beliefs that come from her experiences of victimization. And just as a quick side, on page 10 in the handouts, we've got the worksheet they were using with the client's responses in one typeface and the therapist's suggestions in another typeface. And you can look that out over in your own time. It's another perfectly fine worksheet format that works well. And then the client discloses another episode of sexual victimization that she didn't get around to mentioning at first. She has been, as an adult, sexually abused by a co-worker who happens to be a Christian minister. This is not what Christian ministers are supposed to be doing, but reality. And so they now have a second episode of sexual victimization to deal with. And this is probably going to involve writing an impact statement and, you know, doing exposures to that. As with many people who've been sexually abused, dealing with their sexuality has been an issue. And this has meant that going to a gynecologist has been an issue for her. So they spend a little time addressing that, and they get to the point where the client can successfully go to a gynecologist and get an exam and get a clean bill of health, and we're okay on the sex, the health end of things. And we're doing some more dealing with beliefs and doing exposure to the second episode of victimization. And the client gets around to mentioning, oh, by the way, she was also victimized by a church elder when she was a little kid. And so we've got another chunk of victimization experiences to work on. And we're working on that, and we're also working on assertion and communication, and the client's fears about the therapist's safety, because apparently Fred is running around threatening all sorts of people these days. And we're working on safety, and then Bob shows up and tries to assault the client. The client escapes, uses her coping strategies. Fred threatens the client. The client's hopeless about it. The client is stabbed by Bob. Okay, this complicates treatment a lot. It's much easier to treat PTSD and victimization if people aren't stabbing and assaulting the client while we're trying to treat these problems. But reality is reality. And this is a real-life example. So, we have to work on safety issues and figure out how to arrange things so the client is safe. We now have a new set of experiences to deal with. And they're working on trust, and they're making a police report, and they're getting protection orders against Fred and Bob. And they're working on power and competence, and they're still working on safety strategies, and they're working on self-esteem. And then Fred tries to kidnap the client. And Fred shoots at the client. And he's charged and locked up. And then he gets released on bail. And then he tries to kidnap the client's daughter. And then he gets locked up for good without bond.
Is this really true?
This is really true.
Is Fred the therapist?
Yeah. And therapy works. If you turn to page 11, you have a nice graph of the client symptomatology over 38 sessions of treatment. We got a 10 to 12 session treatment that took 38 sessions for obvious reasons. And you notice that, hey, actually the patient's PTSD symptomatology declined pretty damn well. And her level of depression declined pretty damn well. It did jump when Fred was threatening her and chasing her around town. It did jump when Fred was... it didn't jump when Fred was threatening her. You know, and certainly there were no shortage of crises to deal with. But her BDI dropped from like 42 to 0 at the end of treatment and was maintained in 3 months of follow-up. Her PTSD symptoms dropped from 44 to 0 and were maintained with a little fluctuation through a three-month follow-up. Now, it's a whole lot quicker and easier to treat this stuff if people quit assaulting the client and kidnapping the client and shooting at the client. But we get to deal with the reality we have to deal with. So, you know, CBT sounds simple and straightforward when you outline the protocol. And this is useful, and this gives us a frame of reference and a game plan. But obviously, we're going to have to make major adjustments in our game plan when all this stuff is going on in real life. Yeah, and so it's not a cookbook approach. It's the more complex life is, the more complexity we get to deal with. How's all that sound? Now, so far I've been talking about, you know, treating with sexual abuse, you know, when the client is coming to see us as an adult. You know, now, if I treat kids or adolescents, I'm going to have times when the client's coming to see me, and they're not an adult yet. On the good news end, hey, we get to deal with this stuff earlier. Hopefully, it won't muck up their life nearly as much if we get to intervene, you know, sooner rather than later. And it may be quicker and easier to intervene if we get to do it sooner or later. On the other hand, we're dealing with somebody who's a kid, not an adult, and we're going to need to make an appropriate adjustment. Yeah. One issue that comes up is a lot of people have this idea, oh, they'll outgrow it. And certainly there are no shortage of problems that a person has when they're a kid and they no longer have with an adult. it's not really a matter of outgrowing it. It's not just getting older, poof, is going to magically make my issues go away. You know, as I grow up, I may figure out how to handle things myself. You know, or I may have beneficial experiences which counteract, you know, the negative experiences. But the odds of things turning out well in the long run are a lot better if I get help when I'm a kid than if the adults in my life just figure leave me alone and everything will go fine. You know, it may or may not turn out fine if I don't get help, particularly when we're dealing with heavy-duty stuff. And kids and adolescents are different from adults in a whole variety of ways. This is on page 12 in the handouts. And we need to take that into account. And I'm just going to skim over this real quickly. We've got a chapter in Clinical Applications of Cognitive Therapy about CBT with children and adolescents. But, you know, kids experience the world differently. They experience things differently. Thought processes are different. They're on different footing. They see me as an adult. They're used to deferring to an adult. They're not used to speaking up and establishing a collaborative relationship with an adult. They're used to adults bossing them around and telling them what to do. And so, you know, there's a whole variety of things we need to address in making CBT child-friendly. Page 13, we've got an assortment of suggestions here, which are all good ones. And one thing that's important to keep in mind is just because somebody gets referred to me as an individual does not magically mean I should be doing individual therapy. This is true with adults, too. Just because somebody is sent to me as an individual does not guarantee that individual therapy is the way to go. Now, adults have a lot of agency and autonomy in their lives, and there's a higher portion of the time where working with the person as an individual and helping them figure out how to deal with the other players in their life works fine as an approach to intervention. There's still plenty of times when couple therapy or family therapy or conjoint therapy of other arrangements often turns out to be a good idea with adults. But with kids, you know, you get more and more times when intervening individually with the kid is not the way to go. And where either working with the parents or working with the family is the way to go. If you think about it, you know, the kid is with their family how many hours a week? How many hours a week am I with the kid? You know, I'm going to have to be awful damn wonderful an hour a week to outweigh the impact that everybody else in the kid's life has the rest of the week. Now, if the kid's having problems that have nothing to do with the family they're growing up in, the school they're going to, the environment they're living in, the neighborhood they're living in, then working individually with the kid sounds wonderful. But the vast majority of the time, the family the kid is in played an active role in the development of the problem. The school the kid's in, you know, is dealing with things day to day, the community, etc. And so the odds of success are much greater if I can scope out all of this and figure out which components of this to involve in treatment. If I had to choose one line of treatment for the average kid or adolescent, you know, I would go for family therapy. You know. Now, there are plenty of kids and adolescents where actually what's an even better idea is some individual therapy for the kid and some family therapy and some work with the parents on both their relationship and on effective parenting. Now, we may or may not have the resources to do that. We may or may not be able to get people to sign up for that. But it's a really good idea to think about what constellation do I want to be working with rather than automatically opting for individual therapy. And with kids and younger adolescents, if I can involve the parents and family in treatment in some way, this greatly improves the odds of getting good results. We've got some good data showing that with childhood and anxiety disorders, often the parents have their own anxiety issues and these need to be addressed to do effective treatment. If the parents are modeling avoidance behavior, if the parents are overreacting to stuff, then it makes it a whole lot harder for me to deal with the kid's anxiety effectively just by working with the kid.
Are you saying that in some cases you might do a combo of individual and...
Yeah. Now, I wouldn't necessarily do that all myself. You know, the setting where Barb and I got our family therapy training had it as an article of faith. You never wear both hats. You do either family therapy or couple therapy or individual therapy. Like most things that are engraved in stone, reality turns out not to be that black and white. And there are times when it works just fine to, wear several hats. There are also lots of times when it's a really bad idea. And so this is one of the many things that I want to think about in my initial evaluation and treatment planning. The more Axis II issues are involved, the more it's going to turn out to be a really bad idea to try to wear more than one hat. And so if there are significant Axis II issues, I'm going to do either individual or couple or family and farm out the rest. On the other hand, having too many therapists involved can complicate things and mess stuff up, particularly if they don't do a good job of communicating with each other. That first year of practicum in grad school, we had a family being seen in the psych clinic where mom and each of five kids each had their own therapist and a family therapist, and I think there were a few more people involved in various ways, and several different therapists, psychiatrists doing meds for several different members of the family, and it got really screwy really fast. And was turning out to be a really bad idea. And we had a big meeting with all the therapists and collaborated, and ended up with one family therapist and I think two family members each having their own individual therapy. And things went much better from that point on. But this is something to think about and try to make good choices about. And it's less complex if I'm just wearing one hat. Sometimes it turns out to be a good idea to mix things up some. And it's a whole lot easier to coordinate treatment if I'm doing it all. If somebody else, if there's some family therapist two agencies over who doesn't return my phone calls, then it makes it real hard to coordinate treatment. One thing to keep in mind, if I am doing individual therapy with a kid or adolescent, in terms of coming up with goals for treatment, I need to come up with goals for treatment that are meaningful to the kid and the kid is willing to sign on to. It's real easy. The parents come in, give me their presentation of the problems, tell me what they want out of treatment, and it's real easy without thinking about it to sign on to imposing the parent's agenda on the kid. This is not a collaborative relationship. A heck of a lot of kids are going to fight me on it. It's going to make my job harder, and I may well not win that one. If I take the time to work with the kid and negotiate goals that are meaningful to them, that they're willing to sign on to, stuff that they want to accomplish, then it's a whole lot easier to get the kid to be open and honest with me, to get the kid to follow through on doing what needs to be done. This is going to make my job a lot easier. But if I negotiate goals with the kid that are not cool with the parents are providing transportation, the parents are paying the bill, if what I'm doing with the kid is not okay with the parents, the kid is not going to be coming in to see me. So I need to negotiate collaborative goals with the kid that matter to the kid and the kid's on board with, but they also need to be acceptable to the parents so the parents keep bringing the kid in and paying the bill. And they also need to be ones that I'm willing to sign on to. So it's not unusual for it to take some extra time to sort out goals and priorities. If I'm working with a couple, we need to negotiate couples' goals. If I'm working with a family, we need to negotiate family goals. And this has added levels of complexity and may take some extra negotiating time. The more players are involved, the more complex stuff gets. Family therapy can get very interesting very quickly.
So if a kid shows up at your office, I'm assuming it's because a parent brought them in, which indicates that they're probably interested in participating in some way in that. But I'm wondering, and I guess this would depend on the age of the child, but how do the kids feel about that?
Well, and it also depends on how this has been presented to the kid. Your parents don't necessarily do good judgment in setting the stage for bringing the kid in for therapy.
Yeah.
And it's not unusual for being presented to the kid as, you're bad, you're crazy, I'm taking you to the shrink and they're going to fix you. Which does not set the stage for a collaborative relationship where it's clear to the kid that we're working with them to help them accomplish things they want to accomplish. You know, it's not unusual for parents to say, if you do that one more time, I'm taking you to the shrink so he can straighten you out. And therapy is presented to the kid as a form of punishment. This does not set the stage for etc. And do the parents tell us that that's what they've been saying to the kid at home? No way, Jose. They come in and make it sound like they've been all calm and reasonable and civilized. And, you know, it may be a while till we realize what's actually being said at home. One of the things that's useful about family therapy or about involving the whole family in the initial assessment is often other family members will spill the beans and makes it quicker and easier to find out what's actually happening. And, you know, also, a lot of the specific interventions need to be modified to be developmentally appropriate. We talked about this a little bit back in the beginning in terms of alternate versions of thought shapes for pinpointing thoughts and so on. And on page 16, I've got another alternative, you know, which is just in terms of thinking through a situation and problem solving. You know, this is obviously designed for mid-adolescent. Revising things to make them developmentally appropriate can be real valuable. One of the things I talked about back with anxiety disorders, and it comes up again in dealing with trauma, is, you know, exposure-based interventions are going to be an important part of dealing with the impact of trauma. It does turn out that it's important to remember and face the memories, face the feelings, think through the thoughts. And a lot of adults come into therapy on some level knowing that it is to their advantage to go ahead and face this stuff, even though they don't like the idea. That's a lot less obvious to your average kid and adult. So that when we get to the exposure-based chunk, I'm going to need to put more time and effort into helping the kid understand why it's a good idea to face things they don't want to face, to tolerate stuff they don't want to tolerate, to talk about stuff they don't want to talk about. I'm going to need to be careful to set things up so that we're doing this collaboratively rather than the person feeling like they're being forced to face stuff they don't want to face. And I'm going to need to make a point of taking it in manageable steps. On page 17, we've got an assortment of ideas about that. And parental involvement can be very helpful. It can also be a really bad idea depending on the parents and the kids involved and their relationship and so on. And so this is something to be thoughtful about. How's all that sound? Questions, comments, reactions?
I have a question about the scales that you use to measure the effectiveness of your intervention, the BDI and the PSS. I noticed with the BDI, there are like so many versions. If you just do the, you know, bad depression, I wonder, is there a standard one?
Basically, these days, the standard one, if there is the BDI-2, because it's more recent than the original BDI.
Is that available?
You buy it from Psychological Corporation, which means it costs money.
What about the one that's available online?
It depends on where you're getting it from online. If it's a version of the BDI online, you've discovered somebody who's violating copyright. And if you download it and Xerox a pile of them, you're violating copyright too. Now, the odds are the copyright police will never track you down. On the other hand, I personally am not in favor of violating copyright. And so if you don't want to pay for the BDI, I would say use something else that's free and you got permission to use. You know, personally, you know, There's no shortage of perfectly fine depression measures. There's no magic about the BDI. The BDI is a good depression scale. There are plenty of other perfectly fine depression scales that you can get and have permission to use without paying royalties. I forget, does Mind Over Mood include a depression scale? I believe it
does have one.
And simply by buying Mind Over Mood, you've got permission to Xerox all the forms as much as you want, and so you don't need to violate anybody's copyright. And with depression and anxiety, unless you're trying to do rigorous research, the simple depression checklist, anxiety checklist work just fine. None is dramatically better than the other. If you're doing rigorous research, then you want to use something where you've got good validity statistics, good reliability statistics, and so on. But that's only if you're doing heavy-duty research, in which case you've got a budget and you can buy what you need to buy.
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of working with people with borderline or bipolar,
mm-hmm.
They strive, especially borderline, how they kind of their mood shift.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there is any kind of what's the term I'm looking for? Something to track their. Do you recommend anything to track their mood? So because one of their challenges is not being able to identify really how they're.
Yeah. I personally would recommend keeping it pretty simple and straightforward. I would vote in favor simply having them rate the mood in question on a 0 to 10 scale.
Just any, pick one single?
It depends on, if it's anger, have them rate anger on a 0 to 10 scale. If it's depression, have them rate depression on a 0 to 10 scale. If it's anxiety, have them rate anxiety on a 0 to 10 scale. With your average borderline client, there will be anxiety, there will be depression, there will be anger, and there may well be a variety of other things. And so we could just use a 0 to 10 scale of each of those, and that's a quick, easy, free way to...
With the daily activity scheduling, you mean, like, right?
Well, again, I'm going to want to think about, what do I want to know? If I want to know, overall, what was their mood like today, I could have them once a day rate their overall mood on a 0 to 10 scale, and that gives me a rough idea of what their mood was like today. Now, it's not very differentiated. If I want to track how their mood varies over the course of the day, using an activity schedule format where we've got a block for each hour, and I could have them rate their anxiety each hour and their depression each hour and their anger each hour, and that would give me a sense of how things fluctuate. And I could also have them write down what was the main thing happening that hour, and that would give me a sense of, what the triggers are. If I want a more detailed snapshot, I could have them pick a time when the anxiety was particularly an issue, or the anger, or the depression, and have them do a thought record. And that gives me a very detailed snapshot of what's going on at that moment. And it's a matter of thinking about, what do I want to know at this point in therapy? What's a simple, practical way of doing that? And I'm going to want different information at different points in therapy. There probably are going to be points in therapy where I just want to know overall how are they doing. And there are points in therapy where I want to look at problem situations in lots of detail. And there may well be other points in therapy where I'm interested in other things. So it's the sort of thing where if we were doing rigorous research, we'd need to come up with a standard package of measures we use all the way through. And that makes it possible for us to do cool graphs and so on. But if we're doing clinical work, it's really a matter of what do I want to know this week? And, there may well be a stretch in therapy where I have the person doing thought records every week. And there will probably be other stretches in therapy where I've got them doing other stuff. And there will probably be stretches in therapy where I don't have them filling out specific measures. I have them going forth and doing things differently in real life and then noticing what the results are. And if their memory is lousy, I'll have them write down what happened. If their memory is not lousy, they may well just be able to remember it and tell me about it. And you probably can tell, I tend towards an individualized free-form approach rather than marching people through structured protocols. I find the structured protocols useful as an outline, but I find that tailoring it to the individual adds a lot of value.
Mm-hmm. What I found is helpful with the DBT and tracking their mood is something that I learned about. It's called diary card,
mm-hmm.
and it's very useful. Mm-hmm. Very yeah. useful, easy yeah. to track.
Yeah.
And once they learn how to use it, they'll be able to manage and track their mood.
Yeah.
Without
it's basically a 3x5 file card.
It all, yeah.
Which you can easily stick into your pocket or whatever. And again, I think DPT has a standard format they tend to use. They've yeah. done because they're often doing rigorous research on stuff. But you can also individualize it. Bill Hale at Case Counseling Center yeah. took this course about 15-ish years ago. And he did a pocket thought record on a 3x5, on both sides of a 3x5 card, which was a real nice format. I intended to print up a stack of them and didn't have time and energy to do that. But, and you know, you could easily, you know, take any of the forms from Mind Over Mood and by virtue of using small print, you know, condense it onto a 3x5 card so the person can easily stick it in their pocket and have it with them. Another option these days is there are a variety of different apps that are CBT-based and have various forms of thought records and so on them. There are a number of issues. The idea of using apps makes a lot of sense. These days, everybody's got a smartphone, and a lot of people would rather type stuff into their phone than write it down. There are a couple different issues. One is, do I have the time and energy to preview different apps and decide which one I want my clients using? And recommending stuff that I haven't previewed is not such a good idea because there's good, bad, and mediocre stuff out there. Anybody who wants to can write up an app and put it in the App Store, and just because it's in the App Store doesn't mean it's any good. And some of the ones I've looked at are actually pretty terrible. You know, there was one that has, you know, a format for doing a thought sheet, and then it predicts your thought sheet and says, you're doing this wrong, and you're doing that wrong, and you're doing that wrong, and it underlines stuff in red, and it put big X's and so on. And if I was depressed, that would make me feel a lot worse. And, you know, there are others that are much better. And I personally, you know, can't keep straight in my head which are good and which are mediocre. The other issue to be aware of is if I have the client using an app, what data is the app collecting and what's done with that data? Mm. And a lot of apps are collecting data and reporting it back to the central server, and this is being used for marketing purposes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if I'm taking the responsibility of recommending something to a client, I need to know what's confidential and what isn't, and what data is being shared. And a lot of therapists don't think of that. A lot of clients don't think of that. And, you know, for example, if what I write down on my thought record gets back to my insurance company, is it going to affect my insurance rates and so on? We haven't had any major scandals. I don't think that sort of stuff is going on. On the other hand, given the world we live in, it wouldn't amaze me at all if there is a big scandal in the future because some app somewhere is using information in nefarious ways. You know, if we got the Russians hacking elections, who knows what's going to happen next. So anyway, there's all sorts of issues. You know, using apps is a good concept. I'm personally not doing it yet because I don't have the time and energy to sort out all the many hundreds of apps that are out there, and I don't know what data is being relayed on to others.
So that makes me think, when you have clients do thought records, just on hard copy, mm-hmm. do they bring them in? Do you actually look at them, or do you just leave it to them to tell you what's on there?
It varies. And the ideal way to do it in general is back when we were doing our postdocs with Beck, he had the thought records printed up on this carbonless paper that automatically makes a second copy. And that way the client does their thought record, they bring it up, they hand me one copy, they've got a copy to look at. That's a great way to review thought records. You know, my game plan was as soon as we moved to Cleveland and got set up, I was going to have a stack of those printed up. I haven't gotten to that one yet. You know, it's been on my to-do list for 37 years now. No, 35. So I don't think I'm going to get around to doing that. So in real life, what I generally do is they do the thought record, and there's one copy there. And I usually have the client use it for their own reference and have them tell me about it. Because the important part is getting accurate information. The client can read their own handwriting. It helps them remember the details. They can explain stuff that isn't going to be obvious to me from looking at the thought record. And also, some people are self-conscious about handing it to me and having me look at it, whether they worry about their handwriting or their spelling or does it look dumb or whatever. So often it's more comfortable and goes more smoothly if they just use it for their own reference and tell me what's on it. And so that's what I do most often. But like everything else, I'm, you know, flexible. And if somebody wants to hand it to me and have me look at it, as long as I can read their handwriting, that's fine with me. And occasionally, particularly if it's something complex we're going to be discussing in a lot of detail, I might step to the Xerox machine and make a second copy so that we can each have a copy to look at. And then, when we're done discussing it in today's session, we don't want to just toss it. You know, either I keep a copy in the client's file, or they hang on to it but keep it somewhere where we can find it in the future if we want to make use of it. Because when we get to the beliefs and assumptions stage of things, it's often useful to have a stack of thought records we've gone through to use as a jumping off point for identifying beliefs and assumptions. Other questions, comments?
I have a case.
Sounds good.
This is the again, I just did the assessment. So I need to, if we all have any ideas, that would be helpful. He's 35, white guy, married for 14 years. His wife goes to college in Cleveland State, and she goes to school and works, I guess, as a student, part-time. He does not have any job right now. He is looking for a job, but he does not want to do any kind of job. He wants to work. His degree is in theater, so he wants to work more in wrestling, animation field, in something that he likes to do. So he's not applying for any other job, but it's hard to get a job in that field because you have to know people. That's what he said. When I was trying to see with him, like, what's the problem and, you know, the issues he wants to work on and to prioritize them, he said number one is finding a job that he likes, because right now his financial situation is not good, because he's his sister, because she likes him a lot, that's how he puts it, she gives him money from time to time. The income from his wife is not enough. Sometimes his mom helps. So that's number one. Number two, and he wants to deal, he said he was diagnosed when he was a student in Cleveland State. I don't remember, maybe that's the college. He was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, because as soon as he left to college, all what he was doing is just watching video games all the time, and it took him years to graduate. So he said his problem was depression and anxiety, but when I asked him about the symptoms, he doesn't seem to have enough symptoms to get the diagnosis. But he thinks his problem is procrastinating. So for him to find a job, also in the job situation, and when I explained to him, so how does that play, like, with your depression and anxiety, he said, so when he procrastinates, it creates anxiety for him, because he thinks, what's going to happen if he doesn't do it, you know, the consequences, and then the anxiety level gets higher. And I guess that's how he gets. So I would like to get, you know, a feedback about that relationship between procrastination and that. And the second problem he wanted to work with is he is introducing polyamory to in his marriage, and his wife is moving so slow, and that's disturbing him. So two things. So that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Polyamory. They want to have multiple relationships. The basic concept is we humans are not necessarily inherently monogamous. We can care about more than one person at once, and the idea of having a long-term monogamous relationship is an outmoded artifact of culture, and what we should really do is be open to multiple affectionate relationships. It's very in some circles, and other circles have very strong reactions against the idea.
Did his wife know about the polyamory before they got married? I mean, is this something?
We didn't go into it because he just mentioned it. So I told him a lot of background questions I need to ask for next session.
He's 35?
Yeah.
Does he have any work history?
He said he worked. He worked before, but he worked in the wrestling, the animation. Like, he makes sound effects, and he's a wrestler.
Oh,
so that's the only place where he worked, and he doesn't want to get any other job. He wants to work in what he likes.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm.
So what happened? Oh, sorry. Are we at the stage to ask
questions? Yeah. Well, what questions do people have? What would you like to know?
So what happened?
Go ahead. No, I'm just curious. He's 35. He has a degree, and he has this narrow work history. Mm-hmm. Do you know how long it lasted?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Okay.
I have a lot of questions to ask him, too.
Right.
But I did not ask
him. And he's not willing to be flexible with...
No, he's not. I'm just getting all the... Okay, so who went, trying to figure out...
How long ago was that, the work history that he has? How long ago was that?
He said it's been now close to 2 months that he's not working.
Oh, so just and 2 months ago?
Yes, for his job.
What happened to the job? Did he lose it?
I didn't ask. All of this, I have a whole bunch of a list to ask for next time.
That would have some bearing on, if he lost the job, it has some bearing on him trying to find another job in such a narrow field with such a narrow focus.
His thing is that he's building up a relationship now so that he can have, because he said his field, like, you have to have people, you have to know people who can give you the business, not just. So, and when I asked him, what did you do in that? He was like, I'm trying to build up those relationships now. And sending different applications.
Now, thinking in terms of how we're going to want to go about intervening, one question is, what goals of therapy do we want to sign on to? It sounds like at this point, he's sort of proposing goals of finding a job that I like, procrastinating less, and convincing my wife to sign on to polyamory. And so one question is, are these goals I want to sign on to?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we need to do, some negotiating here? With a goal of finding a job that I like, how is therapy relevant to that? I'm not an employment agency. And I might want to, I would phrase it a little differently. But, okay, so one thing you want to do is find a job that you like. That's understandable. People would rather have a job they like. Is there something that we could work on in here that would be relevant to that? Are there any emotional or psychological issues that get in the way of job hunting? Is there anything... seems like we could work on that would be helpful in the job hunting. If it's just a matter of job hunting, that's not my department. Now, if I ask about it in that way, it might well turn out that there's some anxiety that gets in the way of job hunting. There's some depression and discouragement that gets in the way of job hunting. And this might give us, a result. So it sounds like it would be useful for us to work on the anxiety about job interviews. It would be useful for us to work on the depression.
Or it might turn out that really the issue in that department is his procrastination. He procrastinates about job hunting. And, working to decrease procrastination, something I'm happy to sign on to. That's definitely my department. That's therapy is definitely relevant for that.
Can I ask just one more question? Did he come to you because he wanted to or his wife wanted it to?
No, because he wanted to. And when we, you know, like in the agency, they gave us a form that he needs to fill out. So before even talking to him, what he put in the form was dealing with depression and anxiety and introducing polyamory to my marriage. You see, that's what he put in. That's the sentence that was in there. So when we talked, now he wants more about the job. But then number two is the... So and we ended the whole session by... I told him and said we need to come up with goals. I explained to him what a goal is, and it has to be steps, and I gave it to him as a homework because we didn't have a chance to discuss...
That's a good starting point.
...to discuss, you know, the goals in that one session.
Yeah. Now, another issue that comes up with this is... Yeah, if my client is embarked on a course of action that sounds like a dumb move, do I want to figure they're grown up, they can go forth and do dumb stuff if they want to, or do I want to flag them down and help them think through, wait a minute, is this really a good idea? You know, for the idea, okay, I've got a theater degree, I want a cool job doing fun stuff, I'm going to live off what my sister gives me and not consider any jobs that aren't cool. Hey, a person can do that if they want to. It sounds like it's likely to turn out to be a fairly dumb idea, actually. Our daughter's in theater. I know there are a number of people in theater. And what the vast majority of people in theater do is they've got a day job, so they can pay the rent. While they're meeting people, making connections, doing new cool stuff, and if at some point they get to the point where they can support themselves off of doing cool stuff, then they quit their day job and they're full-time in theater. And the vast majority of people in theater never get to the point where they're supporting themselves full-time at a reasonable standard of living, because that's damn tough to do. And you know, and this applies in a lot of areas. You know, at one point in my life, I wanted to be a poet. And then I learned that Carl Sandburg had to work as a high school librarian to support himself. Okay, that does not sound like poet is a very promising career option. If I could do better than Carl Sandburg, that would be cool. But I'm not going to bet any money on that one. And one of the possibilities is... He may not have had anybody, you know, talk sense to him, help him think through the practicalities of life in theater. You know, if I want to take that on, I could see about how to do it collaboratively. Or I could quite legitimately figure that's not my department. You know, if we want to take that on, you know, we could use a motivational interviewing approach. You know, in what ways is holding out for a fun job, you know, a problem for him? In what ways is that not a good idea? Suppose he keeps it on stop. How's it going to work out in the long run? You know, would it be worth his while to consider if there are alternative approaches to ending up with the kind of lifestyle he wants to have? And, you know, one idea I would end up floating down the road is, you know, suppose I want to end up supporting myself in a really cool job that I really enjoy. Is it to my advantage to hold out for, and I'm only going to take a job if it's a really cool one that I'm going to enjoy? Or would it be to my advantage to take some okay jobs as an interim step? And for example, first of all, how do I know if a job is a really cool job I'm going to enjoy before I've taken it? You know, seems like in order to end up with a really cool job I enjoy, I might need to actually try a number of jobs, even though I'm not sure at first how cool they're going to be. You know, second, how easy is it to get a really cool job I love if I don't have much of a work history?
if I don't have a portfolio, if I don't have people who firsthand know the quality of my work, you know, if I take a boring, ordinary job and do my job well, then I've got a work history, I've got people who can vouch for me, I've got recommendations. Seems like that might be useful in nailing down a cool job. You know, I tend to have a soft spot for people in the arts, so I probably would, you know, take on the trying to convince them not to be an idiot. but I don't think a therapist has any obligation to take on stuff that's not really their department and it's not what the client's asking for help with. And it's not clear to me if he's going to end up asking for help on the job front or not. Those are my thoughts on that part of it. On the procrastination front, in terms of the relationship between procrastination and depression and anxiety, it can go either way. You know, when one is depressed, one feels unmotivated and has trouble getting in gear. And if the time sequence is the person at one point in their life is doing just fine, getting in gear, going forth and doing stuff, taking on challenges and so on, and then they get depressed, and then they can't get their butt in gear, and they're moping around all the time not doing anything. With that scenario, it sounds like the procrastination is a side effect of the depression. We treat the depression, they'll have their energy and motivation back, and they'll be going forth. And yeah, it often works out that way.
For depression, they have to have certain symptoms.
Right. And so one part of it is, you know, does this person meet criteria for depression?
Right, he did not when I asked all of those questions.
But, you know, I'm talking in general.
Yes.
Another potential sequence is if we got somebody who puts stuff off, avoids it for whatever reason, and then they're not accomplishing a lot, they're inactive, they're not being successful, this is a bummer. They may well get depressed as a result of their procrastination, not as a cause of their procrastination. Now, once they're depressed, now they don't feel motivated and so on, so it can snowball. And it can start from either end. Now, a third possibility is if a person's goofing around, not being productive, not accomplishing stuff, where their wife is working her butt off, going to school and working part-time, and she gripes about him goofing off all the time and lifting off his sister, he may well say, oh, I'm too depressed, I'm too anxious. Not because he's depressed and anxious, but because it's a convenient excuse for goofing off, in which case we don't need to treat depression or anxiety. We may well need to deal with procrastination, but we also might want to consider, would it be a good idea for the person to be honest with themselves about what they're doing? You know, and, you know, if I choose to mooch off my sister, hey, that's an option the person's got. You know, if I pretend that I'm, you know, and maybe pretend to myself that I'm so depressed and anxious that I can't do anything else, you know, as long as I do that, that increases the likelihood of my making poor choices. If I choose consciously to mooch off my sister, hey, this is a course of action I'm choosing, and maybe it even suits me. If I end up mooching off my sister because I've convinced myself I'm too depressed and anxious to do anything else, then I'm much more likely to discover that I've chosen a lifestyle I'm unhappy with. So, one idea would be, you know, seeing about getting him to be honest with himself about this. On the procrastination front, you know, this is a problem where the standard takes specific problem situations one at a time and walk through, you know, what the situation is, what led up to it, the thoughts and feelings, what the person does, you know, works really well as a way of developing an understanding of procrastination. Some of the classic scenarios is, you know, I've got a job it would make sense to submit an application for, but I'm anxious about the job interview. Will they turn me down? Will I succeed at the job if I take it or so on? What do we humans do about anxiety? We tend to avoid stuff. And so one thing that comes up a lot with procrastination is I futz around about submitting my application because I'm avoiding anxiety. You know. Another possibility is I've got a job that would make sense to apply for, and I know who's going to want to hire me. This isn't going to work out anyway. I may have a bunch of negative automatic thoughts that discourage me, and so I end up not bothering because it seems like my efforts aren't going to pay off.
And you also can come up with more idiosyncratic stuff. But, you know, some combination of scary thoughts and discouraging thoughts is pretty common. With this guy, it sounds like another element of it may be holding out for the perfect option. You know, oh, I'm not going to apply for this job. The hours aren't right. I'm not going to apply for that job. It's not in my field. I'm not going to apply for this job because it sounds boring. And I can, you know, if I'm perfectionistic enough, I can disqualify every job, so there's no job good enough to apply for. It could be simply, you know, a side effect of my being unreasonably picky, or it could be, you know, this is my way of avoiding the risk of failing, the risk of succeeding, the risk of not living up to my own standards for myself. And, one line of intervention is understanding the dysfunctional thoughts and helping the person come up with adaptive alternatives. Another part of it often is thinking through the strategy they're using. You know, sounds like this guy is thinking, I want to end up with a good job that I enjoy, so I won't take a job unless it's a good job that I'll enjoy. And he's not thinking through, is this a promising strategy to end up? You know, and you know, if he's been doing this for a while, we can look at how well has it worked. Hey, if he's only been out of work for a few months, and there's a reasonable chance for getting a job, you know, that he likes and is happy with in the foreseeable future, why are we discussing this? You know, it often takes more than a few months to find a new job, big deal. You know, my bet is it'll turn out that this strategy has not been working for well for him. He's had a few brief jobs that didn't pay that well. You know, and he's thinking, I need to know more people, etc. And one question is, to what extent is he putting time and energy into networking and meeting people and establishing relationships and so on? But another line of intervention that would be worth considering is, does he know people who've gotten established in the field, who have the kind of job he would like to have, etc.? Does he know how they got to that point? And if he already knows, how did that happen? Does that suggest anything about what strategies would work for him? Or, on the networking front, would it be, if he doesn't know, would it be useful to get together with some of these people, talk to them, find out, and it's going to turn out that they started off doing scut work and put up with it and did well and got advanced and they had a day job to support themselves while they did the stuff they loved until they got established, etc. And it'll lead to a lot more adaptive strategy. You know, both of my kids went to a writer's camp for kids and a sci-fi con that was associated with that. And each year they had panel discussions of the realities of a writer's life. You know, how do you get established as a writer? How do you get published? It turns out the way to end up getting published as a writer is to start collecting rejections. I know somebody who's actually doing damn well writing science fiction now. This year, she just posted on Facebook last week, this year she's submitted 167 manuscripts, or submitted manuscripts 167 times, and she's had 17 published. And that's a good batting average. And she's not, her day job is IT at Case. You know, you don't earn a living writing sci-fi unless you happen to write a blockbuster. And one year they had a panel discussion on how to decide which bills to pay. And part of a writer's life. You pay the electricity bill because your word processor needs to work. You pay for groceries.
Rent.
So you pay for rent, though you can get a few months behind, they don't evict you that fast. Your doctor cannot repossess your health. He's on the list. Your therapist cannot repossess your sanity. They're even behind the doctor. Hope that's useful. And, you know, feel free to post more questions on the Google group, and I can say a lot more about procrastination.
Okay.
And it's now lunchtime. Thank you, guys. Have a good rest of your life. This is it for me. Mark will be here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you've got friends and relatives who are interested in this course, we're going to be mailing out the brochures in a couple weeks. They can find an next brochure on our website, or they can call me or email me, and I'll send them a copy.